Hello and welcome to the Monsoon Project podcast, where we dive into some of the most perplexing and pressing issues facing the Asia Pacific today. The Monsoon Project is the platform for student voices across the Asia Pacific. We are based at the Crawford School of the Australian National University, but we welcome any student with an interest in Asia Pacific affairs. Write for us. Just head on over to themonsoonproject.org for more information. On this episode of the podcast, we'll be chatting about space law with Joel Dennerly. Joel did his honors thesis on the topic of space liability back when he was an undergrad. This rapid expansion that's taken us from rudimentary rockets to mankind actually leaving the Earth and exploring the final frontier comes with a range of issues, problems, and questions as complex as the stars in the night sky. Navigating a way through these challenges will require the expertise of engineers, scientists, astronauts, lawyers, and we. Is there life on Mars? If there is, we need to learn how to govern it to be ready for the changes ahead of us. So strap on your moon boots, take your protein pill, and put your helmet on. Joel and I will discuss everything related to law surrounding the activities of individuals in space to the laws that are related to commercial spaceflights. Hi, Joel. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
Could you please tell me a bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So thank you for having me. My name is Joel. I studied here at the Australian National University. I did a Bachelor of Arts and a Bachelor of Laws, and I'm currently doing my graduate diploma in data analytics. As part of my law degree, I wrote a thesis on international space law, so law that applies in the outer space domain. And I'm currently, for the last few years, I've been working as a consultant. I work as a technology consultant. I work in cyber and IT consultancy for the government.
So one question I actually really wanted to ask you is, you did your honors thesis on space law. What made you passionate about doing it on that? Where did that fascination with space and space law come from?
Yeah, so I started studying law here at the ANU, and I was originally wanting to study and practice criminal law. And I got a few years into my degree and then realized that, look, it wasn't something that I was really passionate about and that I wanted to pursue. But I still really enjoyed the study of law. It's a fascinating degree to undertake. But I've always had a great appreciation of science and astronomy. And as a young kid, my dad and I did quite a bit of amateur astronomy. So I've always adored space and space sciences. And I realized a few years before finishing that space law was a discipline and it was something that you could study. And so I focused my study on international law. And through that, I met various people. And then I decided that, yeah, it was something that I'd like to focus on. So I decided to write a thesis on international space law.
About space liability?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I focused on one of the five UN treaties. I focused on the Liability Convention. The Liability Convention creates a regime of liability that applies for when objects collide in outer space or in airspace or on the Earth. And under Article 2 of the Liability Convention, it creates what's called a strict liability regime. It says that states, countries, are absolutely liable if damage occurs through a collision of one of their space objects with the surface of the Earth or to aircrafts that are flying in airspace. But in every other location, so that includes outer space, in every other location, Article 3 has application. And its scope, it covers collisions that occur in outer space. But how it's different to Article 2 is that Article 3 establishes what's called a fault-based liability regime. And that's really interesting because under a fault-based liability regime, if you are a state that is injured in the course of a space object collision, in order to get compensation, you must show three elements. You must prove three elements. They are causation and damage. And those two elements are typical of all liability regimes. So under a liability regime, to get compensation, you must show that there was damage that occurred, that you suffered damage, and that that damage was caused by the negligent party. But under Article 3, there's a third element, and that third element is that you must also prove that a state was at fault. You must show that the fault of a state caused damage. And that word fault is really interesting in international law. It isn't defined under the Liability Convention. Causation also isn't defined. But there is also no – the Liability Convention doesn't establish a standard of care from which you could ascertain what fault might mean. And so my entire thesis was on the analysis of that one word. I basically was trying to elucidate what the proper interpretation of fault was in order to give effect to Article 3, and so that we had a clearer understanding of how a country would prove fault in the event of a space object collision.
That's very interesting. One of the questions that I had while you were talking is, what happens if someone does breach a treaty?
Yes, well, so the Outer Space Treaty establishes what are called primary rules of international law. And if you breach a primary rule of international law, there are various consequences. The first consequence is that the breach may be dealt with by another document called the Articles on State Responsibility, which outline whether a state has breached an international obligation or a primary rule, and what the consequences of that breach are. So depending on the nature of the breach, it may be dealt with under the Articles on State Responsibility, which outline that states can attain things like full reparations in the event of a harm that occurs. It may also be resolved through other mechanisms. So it could be resolved under the domestic law of the participating states. So it may relate to an issue of contractual nature, and therefore it gets resolved under domestic private law. It could also be resolved through diplomatic channels. And there's an interesting example of where that happened. So in the late 70s, there was a Russian satellite called Cosmos 954. It was a nuclear-powered satellite, and it deorbited. It returned from outer space, but it was an uncontrolled return, and it collided with Canada. I think it was the Northwest Territories of Canada, and it collided, and it scattered radioactive debris across a part of Canada. Nobody was injured, but it was still a collision that occurred. And so this was the first time in history that we had an opportunity to invoke the Liability Convention for damage. And so there was discussions as to whether a claim would be made, because under the Liability Convention, there is a mechanism to establish a thing called the Claims Commission, which is a body that would resolve an issue of liability. But ultimately, the resolution to this incident was that Russia and Canada settled the issue through diplomatic channels. So there was an agreement that the Russian state would pay a sum of, I think, $3 million Canadian for the cleanup. And so there are various ways that issues or breaches of international space law can be resolved.
But do those space treaties apply to private companies and individuals?
No. So the sources of international space law, the five key treaties, they regulate states and international organizations. There is an article under the Outer Space Treaty which specifies that states are responsible for the activities of national organs. They're responsible for governmental and non-governmental activities. And so that responsibility would cover the responsibility to control the acts of private companies.
What if, for example, an individual commits a crime in space? How are they punished? Does their own government deal with the individual, or is there another process that they go through?
Yeah, so it's likely that national law will apply to regulate that situation. And what I mean by that is that it was agreed that international law applies in outer space under these United Nations treaties and general international law. But similar to air law, national law applies to space objects. So, for instance, Australian domestic law applies to an Australian plane that is flying within another country's airspace. And so the International Space Station is a collection of space objects, and there are different national laws that apply in different sections of the International Space Station.
Okay, great. That clears it up. So could a state, so long as it was peaceful, claim territory in space?
It's a really good question. The short answer is no. So under the Outer Space Treaty, there are several, well, it's important to start that there are several freedoms that are established under Article 1 of the Outer Space Treaty. Those freedoms relate to things like the freedom to access and explore outer space, the freedom to use outer space so long as it's for peaceful purposes, the freedom to conduct scientific experiments in outer space. And so these are freedoms that are established under Article 1. So this means that provided you have the capability to get into outer space, any country is free to access and explore outer space. And as you said, you know, well, what would be the result of that exploration? Could countries ultimately claim territory? And it's important to know that the exploration of outer space is different to perhaps the European age of discovery, you know, in the 15th and the 18th centuries, where the preoccupation of city-states and countries and principalities was, of course, territorial expansion. But space is considered a commons, a global commons. It is considered a domain that cannot be appropriated. States can't lay claim to territory in outer space. And so this is articulated under Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty. So Article 2 establishes a concept called the non-appropriation principle. And Article 2 basically says that outer space, including the moon and other celestial bodies like planets, they are not subject to national appropriation by claims of sovereignty, by claims of use or occupation, or by any other means. So that definitive statement of law ultimately answers the question of who owns the moon, and it's nobody.
Okay, so we might never get to own the moon, but maybe we'll get to visit it? I've heard rumors that Blue Origin might start selling tickets for commercial space flights as early as next year. Do you think that's going to happen? And would you be able to comment on the space laws related to tourism and space?
Yeah, so tourism to space is something that I think we'll likely see over the next several years. There are quite a few companies that are considering taking individuals into space. And there are interesting legalities that relate to tourism in outer space. One of the first ones is, where does outer space begin and where does airspace end? And that's a really interesting legal question, because when UNCOPUS, the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, when it was first established, one of the first questions it was asked was to discuss the definition of outer space from a legal point of view, but also the demarcation of outer space. So is there a limit? Where does airspace end and outer space begin? And to this day, there isn't a universal legal consensus on that. Different countries say different things. Some legal commentators may put a number on it. They may say 100 kilometers, for instance, and that was derived from the work of a rocket scientist called von Karman, who set a limit. He said 100 kilometers was a threshold, and it was the highest point at which an aircraft could achieve aerodynamical lift, and it was the lowest point at which an object could maintain a stable orbit. But since articulating that, we've proven that you can orbit lower than 100 kilometers and you can fly one higher than 100 kilometers. So it was a bit of an arbitrary jurisdictional threshold. Why that's important to space tourism is that if you're paying a lot of money to go into outer space, which space tourists in the first instance will, I think tickets cost, you know, upwards of $200,000. If you're paying that amount of money to go into outer space and the trip will only last several hours, you want to know that you've gone into outer space. You want to have a threshold across which you cross and you say, yes, I made it into outer space. People don't want to spend a lot of money just to go very, very high in the air. So you want to have some sort of definition that says, yes, you crossed airspace, you are in outer space, you have that status of an astronaut. So that's a really important legal consideration. There are, of course, other legal considerations that relate to space tourism, things like, you know, contractual issues and issues of liability for damage that may occur to tourists on board spacecraft and things like that.
That's very interesting. That's not something you really think about a lot. Well, maybe you do, but I think it's pretty crazy how far we've come. It's also just really easy to forget the technological advances that we've made.
Yeah, I agree. Why space law is so interesting is it's one aspect of a much larger industry, the space industry. And the space industry is a fascinating industry. And to follow on from your point, I think that a lot of the benefits of the space industry can be quite hidden in society. So, for instance, the largest use of outer space is satellite technology. And the largest use of satellite technology is satellite television. It's things that a lot of us benefit from, that we use. Another important use of satellites, of course, is things like GPS and navigation. So we all have smartphones, and those smartphones are GPS-enabled. And it's an application in your smartphone that we wouldn't have without a space industry. So we benefit directly from that. You know, logistics and supply chain benefit from GPS satellites every single day. And that has a flow-on effect in the wider economy. It means that we get goods transported to us in a more efficient manner. Another really important aspect of space is remote sensing and remote sensing satellites. So Earth observation satellites that take images of the Earth in things like medium and high resolution and synthetic aperture radar. And these are really important applications of outer space because these space assets are generating huge data sets. And these data sets are then downlinked back to the Earth where they're stored in data warehouses. And these data sets plug into the wider economy. They have an application in industries like maritime safety. They have applications in agriculture, improving the crop yields. They're used in urban planning and design, these high-resolution images of the Earth from space. And so space has a really important part to play in the wider economy.
Thank you so much for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Hope it was good.
So listeners, what did you think? How will space transform your field of study or work? The Monsoon Project is really keen to hear your thoughts. You can reach us on Facebook at Monsoon Project or Twitter at Monsoon_Project. Thank you for listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. Bye and be safe.